name is Julia, and I'm here for the week. And this study sort of developed, I was here last year, and everybody was worried about the remediation, and thinking about it, and planning for it, and saying, okay, we embrace it, we're going forward. And so when Cindy asked me to come back this year, I was thinking, wow, I wonder how things are going, you know, since I haven't been up here. And so as I was emailing with Cindy, the idea of under construction, how does the Bible speak to what Holden is going through, and have some language around that. And so actually I brought a couple of the Village Voices with me too. They're up on the podium, that's what I'm pointing over there. because I think a lot of the language that people are using to process is already out there. And so it's been nice to listen in for me at chapel time and talking with folks to hear how things are going. So this is the arc of the week. On the left you have ideal, and then up at the top of the arc, real, and then at the bottom we're going to hopefully get to thinking about what witness is. Each of the studies should be standalone and should get something out of it, and then more out of it in terms of thinking of the whole arc. So this is my title, right? Under construction, and then thinking about the in-between texture of our lives. So there's an ideal that we can envision and imagine and think about, and then there's the real that's ambiguous and messy and chaotic, and you're never quite sure if you're standing on 2 feet or no feet. And it's changing constantly. So that's the balance. And so I picked some texts that we can use to look at this. I don't know what the author's intentions were anyway, but we're looking at Ezekiel on Wednesday, and we'll be doing Genesis 1 today as the ideal vision, and then Genesis 2, 3 tomorrow as the what happens when reality sinks in. And then sort of back in a whole circle to Revelation 17, 18 on Thursday, which is, if you know the book of Revelation, it's this wonderfully scary scene of all the merchants and commercialization and capitalism taking over, and the abuse of people at the bottom and the exaltation of the people at the top. So chaos of society, but which is our experience in quote, the real world outside Holden, but also inside Holden. And then the vision of restoration and the tree of life. So that's the back and forth of the conversation for the week, I hope. And then if you all get totally bored and want to change it, we can do that too. the theme at Holden is being known in the breaking of the bread. Jesus is known in the breaking of the bread. And so there's some really good thinking that has gone on in the village about what that means and how that looks and the brokenness of lives, again, versus the vision of what life could be. So to begin with Genesis 1, it's a funny thing to do because you all know the story, right? I'm presuming you've read it before. I'm presuming you've heard it. I'm presuming you've done Bible studies on it before. So I don't know that I will have a lot to add to your wisdom and study of this. But what I'm hoping is that we can try and experience it a little bit differently than you may have before. And that might open up some things. So I want to start with listening to the text. So I know I told you all to get a Bible, but if you would just listen as I read, and I want you to pay attention to two things. One is the passage itself. What is it creating? Right? I mean, God is creating in the story, but what is the passage creating? And what effect is it having on you? So I may read through it a second time and ask you to think about that again, but pay attention to what's happening in you and what's happening in the reading.
In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth was a formless void, and a darkness covered the face of the deep, while a wind from God swept over the face of the waters. Then God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw that the light was good. And God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness God called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. And God said, "Let there be a dome in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters." So God made a dome, and separated the waters that were under the dome from the waters that were above the dome. And it was so. God called the dome sky, and there was evening, and there was morning, the second day. And God said, "Let the waters under the sky be gathered together in one place, and let the dry land appear." And it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered together God called seas. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let the earth put forth vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees of every kind on earth that bear fruit with the seed in it." And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding every kind of seed, and trees of every kind bearing fruit with the seed in it. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the third day. And God said, "Let there be lights in the dome of the sky to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years, and let them be lights in the dome of the sky to give light upon the earth." And it was so. God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, and the lesser light to rule the night, and the stars. God set them in the dome of the sky to give light upon the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the fourth day. And God said, "Let the waters bring forth swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the dome of the sky." So God created the great sea monsters, and every living creature that moves of every kind, with which the waters swarm, and every winged bird of every kind. And God saw that it was good. God blessed them, saying, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters and the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth." And there was evening, and there was morning, the fifth day. And God said, "Let the earth bring forth living creatures of every kind, cattle and creeping things and wild animals of the earth of every kind." And it was so. God made the wild animals of the earth of every kind, and the cattle of every kind, and everything that creeps upon the ground of every kind. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let us make earthling in our image, according to our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the wild animals of the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth." So God created earthling in God's image, the image of God. In the image of God, God created one, male and female, God created them. God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over every living thing that moves upon the earth." God said, "See, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is upon the face of the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food." And it was so. God saw everything that God had made, and indeed it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished and all their multitude. And on the seventh day, God finished the work that God had done, and God rested on the seventh day from all the work that God had done. So God blessed the seventh day and hallowed it, because on it God rested from all the work that God had done in creation.
So first question is, how would you characterize this passage? What would one or two or three word characterization?
Idyllic.
Idyllic?
Poetic.
Uh-huh. Is that right?
I think so.
Expansive.
How so?
It occurred to me as you were reading it for the first time how it encompasses everything we know about creation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just was stunned by that.
All encompassing.
Yes.
What else?
Joyful.
Joyful. Where do you hear the joy?
In particular, he saw that it was good over and over again.
Yeah,
very good.
When does it say very good?
The very end.
The last one.
Yeah.
It's a sevenfold repetition. God saw that it was good, God saw that it was good. And the last one is, it was very good, when it's all complete. So it's a nice sort of rounding out. When you get to the perfect number 7 and it's all there.
Mm-hmm.
What else?
Peaceful.
Where does the peaceful come from?
There's no strife,
okay.
And there's no struggle. It's given, it's a gift.
No striving. Harmonious, uh-huh. And how is the harmony conveyed?
I think it goes back to it was good. Everything is good and balanced, and there's food for everybody. There's everything that you need. You're satisfied.
Very creative.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Constant giving birth.
There's this lushness of, oh, there's more. Oh, there's more. And there's more.
And then
there's more.
But wait! We're not finished!
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just like the goodness keeps.
And then there's rest at the end.
Falling out. And then there's rest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And the rest. I mean, most of the time we feel like our work is never done, but here, God's like, okay, there's rest, there's completion, there's a doneness to it, or at least a marking before you go on to the next piece. What else about harmoniousness?
Well, I have this sense, and I don't have it in front of me, that that things fit together, that the plants fit with the needs. The needs were met in a suitable way.
Mm-hmm. Another way to say that is there's an order in the creation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's an order and a purpose. Right, so one of the commentaries I was reading says, well, the vegetarianism that's given here in Genesis is revoked in another place later down the line. But you know, the plant, the green things I have given for the creatures to eat, and all the creatures made the green things. You know? So again, not even a natural, what we would call a natural struggle or strife.
Right. That was what struck me, was that you're not out there having to slay things.
Yeah.
Or being afraid. There's no predator prey.
There's no predator prey.
Yeah.
There's just.
Kill the plant, eat it.
It's all provided.
Shh. Sorry.
In the mind of the ancients. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Shh, Charlie.
How else does the order and the harmony come through?
That reflected on the structure each day.
Yeah.
It starts with, you know, then God did this, and then it elaborates on it, and then it says, and then it's good.
Yeah. So there's a, as we said, there's a repetition that creates the order of the visual. The visual order. First comes this, then comes this. Structurally, first day, second.
Is there any significance? This is the first time I've ever heard it this way, I guess, or maybe paid attention to it. Is there any significance to the fact there was evening and then there was morning, as opposed to there was morning and then there was evening? Because
mm-hmm.
I would tend to think about it morning and then evening, but
right,
God's saying there was evening and then there was morning.
That's exactly right. So there are different cultural conceptions of how the day works. Right? So our cultural conception of how the day works is you get up in the morning and that's the beginning. But in the Jewish conception, the ancient conception, you start at evening after you finish your work,
sure,
when there's rest. Right? So you start in the evening. So if you've ever, my husband's Jewish, if you've ever shared a Shabbat dinner with someone or lit the candles on Friday night, you light them after the sun goes down, because that's when you are introducing the blessing on the new day, essentially. Yeah. So it's a completely different mindset, and reminds us that this was another time and place and culture and way of doing things. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So just to be a little tongue in cheek, is that God's cultural conception of how the day works?
Depends whether you take it literally.
Yeah, then we get into hermeneutics and where you place yourself in the Bible, right? But for me, these are a colleague of mine says it's the word of God's people is how he talks about it when he's teaching it. So this is the people's understanding of God as God has revealed to them and as they can articulate. And with Karl Barth, I don't think we can get any closer than that. I think that's as close as we can get to the giganticness of God. So in the language of it, in the structure of it, in the repetition, in the mirroring, you don't get it in the English, but what I love is that if you draw this circle, this there's the separation of the waters, right? So everything is waters, and the Spirit hovers over the waters. And then you put a dome in, and the dome goes up. And now you have a sort of like a tent space in the midst of the waters. And there are waters above and waters below. And now what is God going to create? Birds that swim in the waters above and fish that swim in the waters below. So there's this wonderful mirroring of the heavens, of the waters above and the waters below. Again, a totally different conception of what the world is. And then you have the creatures on the land that do other things, different things. So kind of a another kind of ordering, which is if there is a creature that swims below, there's a creature that swims above. If there's a this, there's a that, you know.
It's a balance.
A balance, yeah, very nice.
Because when I hear it, it's confusing sometimes, you know, because it uses the language and things that haven't been created yet. And we don't have that poetic vision,
right,
of things. So to me, I get confused sometimes.
When you're,
but this will help.
This will help? Oh, good.
Not be so confused.
Oh, good. Did you notice the sea monsters that were created?
Yes.
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 Uh-huh.
The Leviathan.
Yeah.
Where does Leviathan show up?
In the Psalms, in
yes.
Job. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the sea monsters. What effect did the reading have on you? So this is what we can see in the poetry of it, if you will.
It evoked for me like a childlike sense of wonder, like something that's telling me a very comfy bedtime story.
Ah.
It's a calming effect.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's just always calming.
Notes for a bit, and then okay, check my email and see if there's anything else on it.
It's very, there were lots of imagery. Imagery.
I also felt a degree of sadness because I do know people and talk with people who insist on interpreting this story in a literal way, And I thought, as I was listening, and as I said, I thought it was so expansive, so large, and to miss all of that because you want to make it a scientific treatise, I just felt sad for people who miss the beauty and the glory and the grandeur of it.
I often feel that sadness with this first story of Genesis, because I don't, at the same time that everything fits and there's a purpose and an order and a harmony to it, I know that's not how we live. So my sadness comes often there, where there's this beautiful, expansive, as you're describing, understanding of the universe and the world and the cosmos. But then I walk outside and there's trash in the ground. You know, it fragments for me. Or, you know, some kid has stuck their coffee cup in the bush while they walked by because they couldn't put it in a trash can. So a kind of sadness, even with the calming. Any others? The effect of the reading?
Well, for me, it kind of evokes a hopefulness. So I didn't feel sad at all. I was just like reveling in the beauty and the hopefulness of it.
Yeah. And it is beautiful. It's. I don't think it's our normal conception of Western beauty, because there's no detail of color.
Mm-hmm.
There is no detail of texture. The detail is in describing what kind of fruit is on the tree, right? And the Hebrew is very specific. It's a fruit with a seed inside it that's growing on the tree. And could be an apple, could be a pear, could be, you know, a lot of different things. Could be a mango, could be an avocado. There's a lot of different things that in a different part of the world, an olive, would be the fruit that is on the tree.
I like the simplistic of it, the simplistic nature of it, you know, I mean, as I know, life is not simple and things are not that way, but I guess I like it because it is that way.
Yeah. And then you can follow the expansiveness and not feel confused by it, but feel enlarged by it. Yeah. So
instead of overwhelmed, it's not that.
That's it. So yeah, for me, the simplistic and the repetition has that calming effect too, like a lullaby you were saying, like a child cozy in bed listening to a story. So the question I want to get at then is, if what is the function of a presentation of creation that does this, that has this effect on people? Why would that be necessary? And if it has that effect on us, you know, how was it used in other communities of faith over time? And I can't answer the 4,000 years of history of what effect it had on all the other communities over time. But I can set us in the historical context. So Genesis 1, was written, well, it was probably an oral story and passed down, and then it was written down, and it has this whole long history of the human side of it rather than looking at the divine side. But what's interesting to me is that Genesis 1 was written and put together, edited during the Babylonian exile. Have you heard of the Babylonian exile? Okay. The Babylonian exile, I've got some of the dates up here for you. After King David drew all the folks together, all the tribes and everything under his rule, consolidated the kingdom of Israel, Solomon then came into power, built a temple to God, and then almost immediately after the temple was finished, there was a division, and there was a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom. So that probably sounds familiar. The northern kingdom was destroyed by the Assyrians and just wiped out in the 8th century, so around 722. In 622, 100 years later, Josiah is ruling the southern kingdom, and he's in Jerusalem, which is just on the northern border, and he discovers a scroll in the basement. And he tears his clothes, and he realizes that this scroll was how they were supposed to have been following God all along and didn't. And the thinking starts to happen, theological thinking about in the kingdom at that time, that because they weren't following this, that's why the northern kingdom was destroyed, and what they need to do now is get back on track with God and follow the law that they dug up in the cellar that had just been sort of left in the cobwebs. So in 622, King Josiah, as I said, tears his cloak, mandates this reform, and that's the beginning of a scriptural religion, of a religion for Judaism that follows text rather than ritual, which is kind of interesting. So if you want to think about Israel in terms of, a lot of ways to think about it. One way to think about Israel is in terms of following Torah, following the text, right, following the law. Another way to think about it is following the king, the political piece. And another way to think about it is following the temple cult, or the temple rituals, the priests and all of that. So those are three different areas of power that change over time depending on what's going on. Josiah says, I'm going to consolidate not only the temple rituals with the political kingdom, the king and the governance, but I'm also going to raise up this textual piece too, and we're going to follow these laws. And so he pulls all of that together. After Josiah, it all falls apart again. Sort of the history of Israel all the way through. Jeremiah the prophet comes on scene in this mix in 627. And then he is prophesying during the whole rest of this time. We're not going to look at Jeremiah, but he's usually a prophet people know, so it gives you kind of a peg to hang your history on here. In 597, so what's that, almost 30 years later, one of the kings rebels against whoever's in charge. The Assyrians sort of hand off to the Babylonians, and Israel is still under foreign power. King Jehoiakim rebels, and the Babylonians take a whole bunch of the Israelites into captivity in Babylon. So scoop them up, take them east, plant them in Babylon. And now they have to live there under King Nebuchadnezzar. Okay, so the book of Daniel comes into play here, if you know a little bit about Daniel. 10 years later, there's a different king who rebels again and says, forget it, I really don't want to play ball with you Babylonians. And I'm not going to. They kill him. They burn down the temple. Solomon's temple is gone. And they take the rest of everybody into captivity. The people that are left on the land don't have much hope for how they're going to live. The Babylonians put lime. They put chemicals on the land. They trash the wells. You know, you'll hear about, especially in more tribal-led countries in the Middle East right now, when you go in and you take over a village, you just burn down all the crops and you put chemicals in the water, in the wells, so the people can't live there anymore. So there's sort of a subsistence existence for people still in Israel now, but most everybody that has wealth or any power or anything to contribute to a society is taken forcibly to Babylon. Jeremiah himself actually tries to stay on the land and help the people. And then there's some more political intrigue, and he's carried off to Egypt by the people that are trying to escape the political intrigue. So messy, a lot of players, a lot of politics, a lot of upheaval. Now, we're in Babylon, and what's happening in Babylon for 50 years from 587 at the second exile to when another group, the Persians and Cyrus, come up in 539, 538, destroy the Babylonians and let the Jews go home. For those almost 50 years, the Jews are in Babylon trying to hold on to culture, hold on to their religion, raise their children, get ahead, figure out the new language, figure out the new politics. Oh my God, there's new gods we have to worship. So it's a very difficult time. Ezekiel, who we're going to look at on Wednesday, is one of the priests in that time who is attending to the people. So Jeremiah back in Israel and Ezekiel in Babylon. That's the context for when Genesis 1 is put together in what becomes the Torah. So everything we've experienced just in this one reading as calming, childlike sense of wonder, simplistic but expansive, ordering, harmonious, has a particular function for the Babylonian exiled Jews. And that is to do exactly what it did for you. give them some calm, anchor them, let them know who's in charge. The sea monster in verse 21 is really important because Tiamat and other sea monsters were gods. And so it's a little theological poke at the Babylonians who would have worshipped sea monsters or had some background in that and raised them up over the Jewish God who let the people be destroyed. So in verse 21 it says, and God created the sea monsters. Well, they must not be very powerful if our God created them.
Right? Sure. Yeah, our God's bigger than your God.
Exactly. Our God's bigger than your God in a very kind of subtle way that you don't catch unless you're really paying attention. What changes for you? Well, let me say the other piece. This is a priestly text. Priests preserved this text and wrote it down. The Genesis 2 and 3 is actually older than this one. This is newer. To me, it feels like it should be the other way, maybe because I've read them in that order my whole life. But why would this be the priestly offering to the Jewish exiles in Babylon? How is it functioning for them? And why from the priests?
Creation stories are important in all the cultures.
Uh-huh. So everybody would have had one. Yep.
I guess if you were to start out and to have a conversation with somebody and put them on the defensive right away, they're not going to listen to you. Uh-huh. If you calm them and make them feel at ease, there's more tendency that they'll listen uh-huh. to what you have to say. So if you were a priest, I guess psychologically that would be a good way to start out.
For your own congregation?
Well, for your own congregation or the people that you're speaking to or whatever, yeah.
Yeah. For the priests to the Jews are, you're gonna have trouble hearing what I'm gonna say, so calm me down. Yeah.
Do priests have access to God and the people at this time, or how did the
They're in exile, so the priests don't have a temple to operate in. They've been stripped of their essence, if you like. So they're offering a text now to the people as a way to connect to the Creator. Yeah. Everybody's been turned topsy-turvy by this. Yeah. There's another problem, too, for the exiles, which is in the 50 years that they're living in Babylon, the people who actually had been in the temple are dying, right? And the children are growing up
without a temple.
Without a temple.
Without customs.
Without their own culture. They are fluent in Babylonian languages and dialects and not in their own Hebrew. They're more accustomed to what was a foreign culture and a colonizing culture. And so there's a fear of
losing their identity.
Losing your identity, exactly. Yeah.
I think also, like, different empires have always relocated people as a way to assimilate them. Mm-hmm. And the act of relocating the Jews was a way to incorporate all of their culture into the Assyrian culture, kind of like the Mongols or the Incas or whatever. They all did the same thing. They wanted something from them.
So does this text resist assimilation?
Well, in as much as it names our God as creator of their God, it certainly it makes a point.
And it seems to offer, with that expansiveness that you were talking about, it seems to offer a comprehensive worldview that would be a nice, clean alternative to whatever the Babylonians are teaching.
What were the Babylonians teaching?
Right. You know, I'm not an expert in Babylonian worldview. It would have been, they would have had similar creation stories. Water was very important in creation stories. For the Eastern religions, there was a pantheon of gods and usually a hierarchy of gods. So you would have some predominant ones up top, and then you would have some other ones. And then in the East, and this is an important contrast to Genesis 1, in the Eastern religions, human beings were created to serve the gods, to be laborers. This is a different presentation of what a human being is for. What does the human being do here?
Has dominion.
Reflects the image of God.
Reflects the image of God, yeah. And that, go ahead.
I just noticed, and I forgot to ask you about this, you used the word earthling, and I've never heard that word used. Is that your word, or
it's
are you?
My word. The Hebrew is beautiful here, and it goes like this. So God created Adam, little a, not Adam, big A, but Adam. And Adama is the earth. So later in Genesis 2-3, we get God actually creating a human being from the ground. Here, it's just it's a very subtle reflection, dust to dust, earth to earth, that kind of thing. So God created Adam in God's image, and Adam is singular. In the image of God, God created it, Adam, one. I use one because it has negative connotation. I mean, God didn't create a thing, God created a creature. Male and female, God created them. And so God's activity in Genesis 1 is dividing and setting in right order. Make something, divide it, set it in the right order. Make the light, divide it, set it in the right order, right? The water is divided, set in the right order. So this earthling, this Adam that's created does not have a gender, it's not a sexual being, it's a creature that is then divided into the what this culture understood as the constituent parts of humankind. So that's why I do earthling, to get the play on words between a creature of the earth and a non-gendered creature at the time. Yeah.
So you're pointing out this linguistic connection between the earth and the human.
Yeah. Yeah.
What about the plants and the animals? Are they rolled into that whole earth system?
I would so like them to be. but they aren't in this story. So that's my next question. What's troublesome? Oh, and we're at quarter of, so if you need to run away, my what's troublesome question will go about 3 or 4 minutes, and then we'll close.
So that's troublesome.
This is troublesome for me when I read it. The dominion part is troublesome.
Yeah, absolute dominion. Yeah.
I don't know that we exercise that dominion very well.
What's the Hebrew word for dominion? What is that word? Does it evoke any stewardship as well as is it totally dominating? Because
I don't know, but that's a good question.
Because that's why I hate reading the Bible by myself, because I don't know enough of the original language to feel like I have any kind of clue.
Yeah.
And that's what worries me, that we have words like dominate.
Right.
But
right. I'm looking to see if there's any note here.
I mean, when you have a dominance or whatever, it means you have a decision. You have decisions to make, and I think that's the. That's that gift that was given. That's, I always
and
say, it's the best gift and the worst gift that he has ever given us.
Yeah.
Because we don't know. Sometimes we don't know what to do with it, and sometimes we make the wrong decisions.
I think that dominion does imply stewardship, because if you have dominion over a territory, you're responsible for. It, as a government, for example, you're responsible for what goes on and for making things work. And so I don't read dominion simply as power over.
Mm-hmm.
I read it as being responsible for what happens.
But,
it's your pool. You can pee in it if you really want to.
Yeah. But see, that's a difference in a way. I mean, that's kind of almost a political thing that you get into, because some people believe that we do have dominion. We can use it whatever and use it just the way we
want. I hate that content.
So I mean, I agree with you, but I know
I
people.
Think they're just not really. I just looked up the word dominion to back myself up on that, because I think that's a misinterpretation of what dominion means.
I have a side note that says having dominion is understood as caregiving, not exploitation.
That's nice.
It's the Lutheran Study Bible.
The NRSV scholar editor, I think his name is Hanson, says that what's imagined here in the original cultural context is the dominion of a king, which could be beneficent and tyrannical, depending on right. But does imply stewardship. Does imply
a good king
who
cares for his subjects and treats them well, because it's more paternal.
Right. But it is a kingly office that the humans are being assigned versus the laborer office that the Babylonians would have assigned.
That's interesting.
Say it another way, the humans are not slaves of the gods, they are regents in the place of the gods. Kingly type people. Anything else that trips you up, sticks out, gets in the way?
Is that referred to as infertile in this? Somewhere there's our?
Yes. I see what you're saying. Yeah. Let us make them in our image. Let us make humankind in our image. Yeah.
Mm.
And so again, the Eastern concept of the divine was that you may have had one single ruling god, but then there were lots of demigods who had specific offices to take care of. And so it reflects the heavenly court understanding. So for a Jew, that would have meant, well, the angels and the heavenly creatures that are supposed to do what God says. For a Babylonian, it would have meant, well, all the demigods.
Fire, water, sun.
Who are in charge with. So for me, what's interesting about this priestly text is that the priest is empowering the people, right? You were given dominion, even though people are dominating over you right now.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an empowering point. Again, different to here if you're in captivity under people than if you're, you know, the United States on top of the world. Right? So where you are in the social structure and how you hear that dominion changes the tone. Not necessarily the effect of your behavior, but maybe what it was meant to do. So we have the ideal, and then we have these little things that trip us up. I wanted to read just a little bit from the Holden, the voice of Holden, right? This is from Stephanie and Chuck's piece in the Village Voice.
You might ask, is this for real? Holden Village, the place where we have discovered things called Spanakopita and Hunger Awareness Days? Holden Village, where countless volunteers have learned to lovingly make bread and feed the multitudes? Is this Holden Village, where societal norms have been challenged, the edgy place where environmental ethics have been debated for decades, now working with Rio Tinto, one of the largest mining companies in the world? From one perspective, it all looks like such a sellout, right? There's the ideal of Holden, and then there are things that trip us up. Conformity, abandonment of high-minded ideals. And then they go on to take from another perspective. And then again, the question, this is from John Jensen, what is it about this place? What's the recipe that makes Holden work? And what's the key ingredient? Like after enjoying a phenomenal meal at a restaurant, I want the recipe so I can take it home and make it in my own kitchen. I want to take the feeling of Holden Village back with me, so I need the recipe. At one level, the recipe is obvious. It's in the mission statement. Maybe it's the place that first drew me in. I heard many people say that Holden could not exist anywhere else. Here in Railroad Creek Valley, we're surrounded by the wilderness. We can't escape it. Look out the window, walk down the street, and there it is. It's what draws us here. So we can even hear in the voices in the village this tension between the ideal and then wrestling with, okay, the ideal is, but then the question is, what does the ideal do? And it seems to have pushed Holden to a place of saying, all right, well, let's be open in this way too. Let's be motivated in this way too. And there's ambiguity because of the situation, but the rhythm and the harmony and the calming and the all that people are holding on to about Holden Village is also a motivating factor to be able to walk through all of the present chaos.
I think there's just, I just have to say, listening to you say that, there's two things that come to mind. One is the very intentionalness of us maintaining some of the most sacred rhythms
mm-hmm.
here,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that we didn't think we could do it, and lo and behold, there were some people who dreamt, and we have Holden on the road and Holden on the trail,
mm-hmm.
and it's a fantastic opportunity for us to morph into something even more expansive than we already were.
Mm-hmm.
Be able to, and I feel like the programs that have been started right now could potentially continue on indefinitely,
mm-hmm.
and that's really exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And it become accessible to people who couldn't get here physically for one reason or another.
Mm-hmm.
That's another fantastic opportunity.
Mm-hmm. And more people coming in that haven't experienced before.
Yeah, it's tangentially, you know, it's just amazing. Just amazing.
One of Scott's articles in the Village Voice talked about exactly what you said, keeping the rhythm central. And that's what this Genesis 1 is doing. How does a priest hold it together for a community that's feeling a little chaotic? You keep the rhythm. And you keep attending to that rhythm and the cycles of the worship and the ritual, and that's what a priest can offer. They can offer a lot more, but that's one of the structural things that can be offered to you. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks. Great. Well, let's have a brief prayer to close us and then send us to dinner. God, we thank you for your presence in the still, calming, simple voices that we hear, the calling back to be in the place where you are and where we can feel our feet solidly on the ground. We give you thanks for the history of your people and the witness to difficult times and texts that can speak to many different places. We give you thanks for all who are here and for all of the work of the day. In Christ's name, amen.
Amen.
Blessings.
Thank you.
We'll see you tomorrow.
Yeah.